It's cool that you're doing this still, and I still haven't listened to the one with you and Travis, but I've been meaning to.
We've got, I should give you the one where Rachel was here on one, and the one with Travis and I was pretty funny, but when Rachel came in, I think that one ended up being like 2.5 hours or something, and I don't know, we were having a good time with it so far. I'm pretty impressed by how we've stayed committed to it, because I don't know, I think that's probably the hardest part of these things is keeping yourself committed.
Consistency is what's really going to make the whole thing shine, because you'll get more comfortable, more ideas will spring forth. You know, you'll have different ideas that'll come to you while you're going throughout the day, and then you'll bring it back up here to the loft.
Yeah. Well, the first one we did, it was kind of funny. We, I didn't have the right mic connections. So we literally had this little piece. I had like a little lavalier mic, and it was connected straight into my phone. And so the first two were straight into the phone. And now we've had some people donate some equipment, which is cool. We've got some new mics coming. After the first of the year, we're going to have a sweet new board, a digital mixing board, which I'm pretty excited about, but that's just because I'm a sound nerd. So
audiophile, I think is what it's called.
Yeah, that's a good, yeah. Audiophile, do you know what cenophile is?
No.
A cenophile is a lover of dogs.
Oh.
Yeah. Right, I do the,
got a couple of things going on
there. Yeah, man. It's funny because I've got these couple of pretty good, Instagram accounts that I follow that give me like thoughts or words of the day. Mm-hmm. And the word of the day ones are really cool because I take that word and I try to use that word at least a couple times during the day in conversation. And then some of them, I don't always remember all of them, but I've been pretty good so far remembering them.
Do you know what the word of the day is today?
No, let's look. Hang on. Let's look and see.
Let's see if we can work it into the conversation today.
We will. I'm sure we can. Let me see. Oh, okay. Here it is. Compathy. It's either compathy or I think it's compathy. Yeah, compathy.
See, you know, that sucks when they give you this, you know, word that has some sort of ambiguous spelling or something like that, and you try to use it, and you find out that you've been saying it wrong
the whole time. They put the...
like poignant. Poignant.
Yeah.
That's a poignant thing you just said.
Yeah, so compathy is a shared feeling. Mm. So, like if we, I don't know. I guess we'll have to see if we can use it. But if we have a point where we felt, where we're talking about something and we felt the same thing, that's compathy.
Let's each take a sip of this awesome wine at the same time, and I bet we will.
Yeah,
let's see. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Start this thing off.
Okay, let's do it.
So, welcome back to the show, everybody. It is the week before Christmas, and I've got my good buddy Josh Hall here. How you doing, man?
I'm great. It's good to be here. I'm looking forward to exploring some of these topics that we got going on.
Yeah, this is going to be awesome. So, I want to start out. I think I generally the way that we like to do this is You know, I think a lot of people are like show preppers, mm-hmm. and I am. I like to think through things, but I don't write a whole lot of stuff down to prep because I like the conversation just kind of go where it wants. Mm-hmm. But I want to start out. I like asking everybody I like knowing people's origin story. Mm. So, and I like taking little things that I have kind of in common with people and then finding out like how those are dispersive. Right. So you and I are both originally, I think, from the South, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So, okay, tell me about that. Tell me where you're born, grew up, all that stuff.
So I grew up in this, well, after my parents were divorced when I was around five, my mother was remarried, and we moved to this little shithole town called Eatonton, Georgia. Actually, the county.
Georgia boy.
Yeah. And, I mean, when I say shithole, I really mean it. It was just, the main industry was a trailer manufacturing plant.
What side of the state is it on? Coast side or, like, inland?
It's, like, 90 miles sort of southeast from Atlanta.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, there's great people there, right? But with the way I grew up was basically I was called white trash my whole life.
Yeah.
Until I left, you know. And growing up under the, you know, you develop all these ideas about yourself. And for me, I didn't really realize it until I was in this, like, later on in my life, right? But when I left Georgia to move in with my father in Alabama, in Huntsville, Alabama, I was very insecure, and all I wanted to do is prove that I was worthy of respect.
Did you think, when you left Georgia, did you think you were white trash? Or, here's a better question.
Right.
Because now, obviously, you know, we've grown up, we've had, like, careers, we've done things, mm-hmm. we're much more intellectual people. Were you white trash? Because I will say, coming from where I came from in North Carolina, I'm not going to say that I was, like, white trash, but I think the persona that a lot see as white trash.
If you're from the South and you leave the South, everyone thinks you're just some sort of ignorant rube.
Yeah, there were probably times in my life where I was white trash, and I just didn't really realize it, you know?
Well, no, I wasn't. I never was, of course not, but the perception was, I mean, we were poor back then, you know. My stepfather, if he didn't kill a deer, we might not eat meat that week. It was really like that.
Really, it was that?
Wow. Yeah. He worked at the trailer manufacturing plant, Horton Homes, and I didn't really know we were poor. I just, you know, I went to the public school with other poor kids, and I didn't really realize it until I went to private school. My grandfather paid for me to go to private school in Milledgeville, Georgia, this Georgia Military College.
What ages was this?
Sixth grade. That's okay. When I went there for the first time. And I remember, you know, on show and tell days, right, you bring in, like, whatever, or it's the class party type thing. And this is when I realized I was poor. I showed up with my boombox that my father had bought me, you know, years before. And I thought it was cool because every year I brought this thing in, everyone was like, all right, great. Well, when I went to the private school with this thing, it was, of course, obsolete, kind of busted, and they made fun of me for it. They made fun of me for it. And that's when I realized we don't have anything.
Right.
You know, for the first time, really. You got to understand, I grew up in my house, we had a wood-burning heater.
Yeah, like, we had a wood stove, too. We grew up with a wood stove.
Yeah.
Summers
were spent getting firewood for us. That's how we heat our home all winter long.
Yeah,
and that made me strong as hell.
Well, I will say, okay, so that's a little different with us. Like, we did have HVAC, but we didn't really use it much because we had, the wood stove in the winter would heat the entire, I mean, those things get hot. It's much hotter than just a regular fireplace. People don't understand how, if they've never had one.
Yeah.
Those suckers get hot.
Well, let me tell you, when they go out, it gets cold. I remember.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, where my brother and I, we had a room that we shared, and it would get freezing cold in the middle of the night, man. And so I would go out there and lay in front of that thing, but eventually it would die out, and I'd wake up, you know, shivering in front of the heater or whatever. But it was wild. I can't believe the way I grew up, man. I cannot believe
it. Isn't that crazy?
It.
I was talking to somebody the other day, and I said, it's insane. We were at the dog park, mm-hmm. and we were talking about the principle of how we take our dogs to a fenced-in park, and we make sure that our dogs are within visual sight of us.
Right.
And I said, I grew up in a place where at like 7 or 8 years old, the rule was I could go play as far off in the woods as I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But when my mom, we had a dinner bell, when she rang the bell or yelled for me, that was the rule. I had to be within sound of her voice.
Sure.
But other than that, she didn't have to see me. She didn't have to hear from me the whole day. No phones, no nothing back then. Mm-hmm. And this was legitimately at right around like 7, 8 years old.
Yeah,
I was off doing this.
Yeah,
and if you did, there's no way you could do that with a kid now.
Splash around in the creek, you know, jumping through brush piles, like snakes.
Yeah, I remember picking up rocks in the creek and just snakes just being there, and you're like, oh, it's just a snake.
Right.
And now that would be like child endangerment. But to think about how much we've changed as to where now. We used to just let the dog out and like,
sure.
the dog was going to come back, but the dog could go do whatever it wanted. And now it's like, I have to be within visual range inside a fenced park with my dog.
Right.
I don't know. It's just, it's wild.
Hey man, you know what's crazy? We had dogs. We never had a single fence.
Yeah.
And anyway, every dog we had, every dog, eventually would run out into the road and get hit. And I must have seen three of the dogs that I love hit right in front of me.
Really?
And there's nothing you can do. Yeah, because the dogs would follow us down the driveway, which was super long. People used to drive into our driveway thinking it was some dirt road that ran, you know, some random place, but it was our driveway.
Yeah.
And while we're waiting for the school bus, the dogs would follow us. And of course, we knew it was a matter of time. I mean, we knew it. And I would throw rocks at these dogs, go back, you know, because I didn't want them to come that close. But eventually, they would all get out into the road, and it was so horrible, man.
Yeah, and that's rough.
As a kid, I mean, it was traumatizing. Your best friend gets hit by a car right in front of you three times.
Yeah.
And my parents were just like, well, that's what happens. I mean, no, that's not what happens. That's what happens when you're a shitty dog owner. But I was a kid. I didn't know any better. I mean, what do you do, you know? Anyway, but yeah, so to answer your question, no, we weren't white trash. We had a lot of dignity about ourselves, and we just didn't have money back then. But they turned that property into a beautiful place. It's a ranch. I mean, they improved it over, 30-something years.
Still there.
They're still there. Horses, gorgeous. I mean, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was like we were clearing this land.
Yeah.
My stepfather found a house that was in an abandoned house in a field, and he put it on blocks and moved it to where they settled.
Dude, moving houses is crazy, man.
It's crazy.
So I grew up in, my father's in construction, and I've seen pretty much everything that you could think to see in the construction world, from private to commercial. But moving a historic or old house, that process is crazy.
Yeah.
I remember,
got to cut it in half and stuff. It's wild.
Well, some of them, like the craziest thing that I've ever seen is, I can't remember how long ago this was, but it was maybe like the mid to late 2000s. They had to move the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse, which is the largest, as far as I know, I think it's the largest lighthouse on the East Coast.
Mm.
It's in North Carolina. And the erosion, they just had to move this thing.
Right.
And so they jacked up this entire, the thing is, it's well over 100 feet tall, massive brick lighthouse. Like, you know, it probably weighs similar to what one of the old space, you know, rockets weigh.
Sure.
If not more, I don't know. I'm kind of talking out of my ass there. But they had to jack this thing up and put it on rollers and move it.
Yeah.
Like, they moved it like a mile or not. They didn't move it like a couple hundred yards. They moved this thing like a mile or two, and it was just, I don't know. That's wild to me.
I mean, just to tell you, my uncle, he was this wild man in Mississippi, but he moved one of these old southern mansions like all the way across a county or something like that. But they sawed this thing into two or three different pieces and moved it like that. And that's the house they lived in.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah,
and the
big columns and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the whole thing.
If they were to do that now, they, like, our families would have house shows on these, like.
I mean, it's an antique house, isn't it? I mean, it's something, I don't know. But yeah, to tell you more, so I'll just tell you, when I moved in with my dad, the sport of wrestling is what I wound up going into full on.
Right.
Wrestling. And it's the most thankless sport, but it's one of the toughest, most badass sports on the planet. And I wound up being really fucking good at it. And it gave me a sense of identity. And that reinforced everything that I ever wanted to be a part of because I was winning.
So when that happened, were you still in Georgia or are you in Alabama at this time?
Alabama at this point, okay. Yeah. And but it became...
How old were you when you started wrestling?
Seventh grade.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
In seventh grade is when I started wrestling. And, you know, it's really... In a lot of ways, it's what shaped my life completely because, as I say, it gave me a sense of identity, but it also had a double-edged sword. See, my value, and I think a lot of athletes wind up doing this, is my value was totally dependent on my performance. So every match became like a life or death sentence.
Right.
You know, and I don't know, things like injuries. You know, when you're an injured athlete, well, you're less than dog shit, yeah. And you get treated that way. But if you win, you get treated completely different. It's just the craziest thing. And for me, you know, I wound up placing fourth in the Olympic trials from Alabama. That was something that at that point in time, like, was unheard of, you know. But that brings me to another point. See, I wrote this list of things to do before I die when I was 17 after being attacked by these guys with knives. I had a near-death experience. It was wild. It's the day of my senior prom.
When you're 17?
Yeah.
Day of your senior prom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Still went to my senior prom afterwards, too. But...
Wait, what happened? Whoa, you can't... What happened? What? You got to tell what
you... All right. So, my best friend and I at the time... I don't know how you guys did things back in the day, but, see, we would go... We all would... As a group, like we'd go to this hotel after the dance, and on the way in, like all of our alcohol get confiscated. So this time I said, wait a minute, let's go during the day when no one's expecting it because we've got the rooms. Let's drop off the beer now.
Yeah.
And so my buddy Shane and I got in the car and we're driving down the road and we're pumped, you know. And that's another thing. See, at this point in my life, I had sort of developed this reputation as this fighter, this kind of like badass or whatever in you know, my high school little circle. And this was like part of who
were
I was.
Were you doing, were you just wrestling at this point or were you in any other martial art or anything?
You know, the UFC had just started. Like, it was a crazy
fringe sport.
And we'll
talk about that, but at this point, you hadn't gotten involved in
it. No. It was purely wrestling. Was my only experience with combat, you know, the combat sports or whatever. And but I wasn't a bully. See, that was my thing. Like, bullies were who I liked to beat the fuck out of because you're allowed to beat up bullies, right?
Like, no fighter. I've met a couple of UFC guys. I've known a lot of collegiate wrestlers.
Yeah.
I've known a couple of like national champion Taekwondo guys, a lot of Muay Thai fighters.
Yeah.
Real fighters, like real badass fucking dudes, mm-hmm. are some of the nicest people. And they don't have anything to prove.
That's right.
Yeah.
They might not put up with any bullshit, but they don't have anything to prove either. And
right.
But see, at this point in my life, I did have something to prove.
Yeah.
I did have something to prove. And for me, my whole life was a struggle about feeling worthy of love, worthy of...
Where did that come from, do you think?
Well, it was an insecurity about the way I grew up, being told that I was... Well, it's a long story, man. I mean, I had spinal meningitis when I was six, right? And during this time, my parents were getting divorced, and I was in this hospital for 6 weeks, and they didn't come see me. I was in a hospital
really?
By myself. Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, how old were you?
Six.
Six.
Can you imagine that though?
I mean, nobody
I couldn't
came
sit
to see
still
you.
I couldn't sit still in a car for 2 hours and I was in bed for six fucking weeks, man.
Dude, that's crazy.
I had to go to physical therapy just to walk again afterwards, and I didn't want to because it hurt so bad to try to walk.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so to move past this thing and to tell you where, kind of give you the background of what was going on. We were on our way to this hotel to drop off our beer before the night of our senior prom. And I was exhilarated. I was like, this is great. I'm so pumped up. I kind of want to get into a fight right now.
Really?
Yeah. Because I had this part of my identity needed that.
Yeah.
Needed it.
I mean, I've been in that mood before too. I think it's just a guy thing that happens sometimes, but to just hear somebody say it,
yeah,
like I just want to fight right now.
It's just the testosterone, the masculinity, the, you know, whatever it is, the toxic masculinity, really. But
yeah,
but that's what happened.
And isn't that wild that we all, at some point in our life, we just, it doesn't matter whether we're like big or small or can fight or not.
Yeah,
at some point you just feel that.
Well, but this is how things manifest. See, that stronger emotion, plus that was what was on my mind, and you become like a magnet for whatever it is that you're feeling.
Right.
And we attracted the most horrible thing that had ever happened to us, both of us. See, when I was driving down that road, we came to a stoplight, and right next to us was this Mustang with the tinted windows, the window, you know, that rolled up and everything.
Love a good Mustang.
Yeah. Well,
I'm a Ford guy.
Well, I look over, and you kind of see this girl in there, right? And both of us, between me and Shane, we were like, you know, kind of popular guys, whatever. He was an All-American football player. I was, you know, a 2-time state champion in wrestling at this point. And we look over, you know, and the guy in the passenger seat sees us looking over, and he just leans over, and you see the silhouette give us the finger,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I was kind of like, well, fuck you too, you know, because this is how it was in the South. This is how it was.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd go out and try to get a girl, and if you didn't get a girl, you got into a fight.
Yeah, you just
That's
fight.
Just how it worked,
yeah.
Right? So these guys, you know, this guy leans over, gives the finger. We give him the finger back. The light turns green. We start going. Well, this guy jumps levels on us. I just wasn't used to this. These dudes were gangbangers. And this guy gets out of his passenger side window and throws a bottle at my car over the top of it and hits it. And I'm driving, right? And I was like, I'm pull over, motherfucker. I'm going to fuck you up, you know. And this guy's like, hey, you know, jawing at me. And he leans back and he starts waving. And me and Shane both look back behind us, and there's this pimped out cherry red Cadillac.
Nice.
Filled with five other guys.
Oh.
Probably. I mean, like a car full of guys, right?
Yeah.
And I look at this, and I look at Shane, and I was like, let's beat the fuck out of these dudes. I wasn't scared at all. I was like, okay, this is great, you know. Well, I didn't see it, but one of them like flashes a gun at Shane, and Shane's like, Josh, they got a fucking gun. And I remember thinking, what? There's like six of them. You mean they got weapons too?
Yeah.
I mean, that was just, I wasn't ready for that. I mean, I'm 17 years old.
Right.
You know? So.
Let me ask you this question real quick. Were you, at this point in your life, were you as jacked as you are? Have you been like the same composition?
Yeah.
Pretty much your whole life?
Yeah. I mean, I was a fanatic. You see, you got to understand, in my universe, my only value was winning at wrestling.
Yeah.
That was it. That was it. And if I couldn't protect my friend, that was the other thing. I was a protector. If I couldn't protect my friends or win at this stuff, then I was worthless. I really thought that.
Well, the reason I ask is, well, there's two reasons I ask. First of all,
so I was training my ass off. I mean, in high school, I was a freak. Yeah.
I asked because through high school for me, I didn't really grow. Mm-hmm. I was probably like 5'6" or 5'7"
mm-hmm.
when I graduated high school. And now I'm like right around 6'1".
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what it's like to be dudes like you, because there are some dudes that are, I mean, we're not even the same like body type at all. But, you know, to think, my point is like, without knowing that you're kind of a teddy bear, you're an imposing dude, right? So for somebody to step up, for somebody to step up on me, like maybe I could fight, maybe I couldn't, but I'm not an intimidating person. You could be, you have a very intimidating presence just on your stature. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that. See, everybody, and this is going to get kind of out there, but I'm going to get out there.
Let's do it.
Everybody kind of projects this sort of image of themselves onto the world while they're walking the earth, right?
For sure, 100%.
Yeah. And it's not really them, usually. And it's, a lot of the time, it's based on a lot of negativity. And mine was based on all kinds of negativity.
Right.
Trauma you never want to relive again type of negativity. And one of the things that I had going in my image was, don't fuck with me. Do not fuck with me. And because of that, see, the way this works, the way I believe the universe works is, if it's coming from a place of negativity,
right,
and you're putting all your mental energy into this entity that's supposed to represent you, but it's not really you. You see, it gives you either the opposite of what you want, or if it gives you what you think you want, there's just never enough because it's based on negativity. So in this case, "Don't fuck with me" brought me nothing but conflict.
Right.
Conflict, man. And worst of all, it was always conflict with the people who were closest to me. Because when you have that kind of thing going on, all you see are reasons to justify your persona.
Right.
And so in this case, it was like a magnet for these guys. I mean, have you ever seen, you see it all the time on the road, right? Some guy's got speeding down the freeway. What happens? He rolls by someone. Next thing you know, that guy's being followed by someone else.
Yeah, dude.
They're like magnets for each other.
That's why I never drive my Mustang in and around town. Because it's like, even if it's a subconscious thing, that thing just attracts negative energy. And so I only drive it on the times when I can get out of town and drive out on the back roads. It's just not a good car to, but it's the same thing. Like whether I didn't buy that car for appearance or for anything else, but
you enjoy driving, that's one of the things that makes you feel alive is driving. Cause you're good at it.
Yeah. But subconsciously, like it still attracts that energy in town, right? Because it's,
you know, if you drive aggressively, someone's going to see it. And it's going to hit some nerve with them, and they're going to react to it because.
Well, it's kind of like you. We're talking about you. Like it's not. I don't drive aggressively at all. Megan will tell you that's the exact opposite. Actually, she drives most of the places, but the car, like dudes get aggressive.
It's an aggressive car.
Yeah.
It's an aggressive car.
Anyway, continue. So.
Right. Yeah. So anyways, and that's really what I had going at this point in my life when I was 17 was don't fuck with me, and. Really, the reason why is because I've been hurt before, and I don't want to be hurt again. And that was it. But see, when these guys started doing this whole thing, and that extra carload of guys was up there, and I realized, we're literally outgunned here.
Right.
You know, they've got a fucking weapon.
That's crazy.
And so I didn't know what to do, but I did what I thought I had to. I yanked the steering wheel over to the right, and my plan was to get the hell off the road and go, you know, off the side street.
Right.
As soon as I did, the car in front of me was the first car, right? They slammed on their brakes, and I almost rear-ended them, and the car behind me pulled up right behind me. You've seen all these scars all over my body, right?
Yeah.
So.
Oh, is that what the big one?
Yeah.
This is a story that the big one's from.
Yeah. And, I mean, you see it from the pool and stuff. So I couldn't go forward and I couldn't go backwards.
Yeah.
And I'm still like not fully conscious of just what fucked up situation we're in, right? And I'm trying to roll up the windows, you know, because they're...
What kind of car are you in?
This is like a Honda Civic. It's my dad's car.
Right.
They're trying to stab us through the open windows at this point. And I remember becoming enraged by this. I said, "Shane, get out of the car." And we jumped out of the car, and I ran around the front of the car, and I hit this motherfucker right in the face. And I remember over the top of his right eye, just this big cut formed. And as soon as I thought, yes, I just got his ass, I felt this searing, horrible pain in my lower back.
What?
And I whip around, and some guy had, I realized I'd just been stabbed in the back.
What?
I'd just been stabbed, man. And I looked at this guy, and I saw
that
this knife
bananas.
In his hand.
Bananas.
Bro. I was like, I'm about to die on the side of this fucking road, and I'm only 17. And you see, I just started throwing everything I had at these guys. And I'm fighting like two or three dudes at any given time. And I remember I kept looking over to check on my friend Shane to see if he's okay. Because in the back of my mind, this is all my fault. This is all my fault. And
really? That's what you're thinking?
100%. 100%. And I look over, Shane's got, like, on top of this one guy, throttling him. And I thought, okay, he's okay, good. And I'm fighting these three dudes, and every time I turn to hit one, one's behind me trying to cut me, you know? They had box cutters.
Dude.
And the one guy had a knife. And so I finally hit one of these guys, Scott, and knock him down. And I thought, yes, now there's only two of these son of a bitches, you know? And so I start fighting these guys. And again, I look up to check on my friend Shane. And I see the guy that I just knocked down on his back. And I know he's got a knife. And so I grab one of these guys and throw him to the side. And I start running over to Shane because this guy's on his back. And I knock the guy off of his back. But by the time I'm over there, he's been cut so badly on the back of his neck, all the way down his back. I mean, it was bad. This sick guy actually lifted up a friend Shane's shirt so he could see himself cut him down his back.
What?
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. These guys were animals, man.
People are savage.
Bro, but look. See, we attracted it. We attracted it. You know,
that's such a crazy theory, though, to think about.
Well, so check it out. It doesn't end there, though. See, at this point, my friend's completely out of the fight. I thought he was dead. He's not moving. He's on the ground. And I'm standing over his body, and these guys are circling around me. And have you ever been so fucking tired that you want to puke?
Yeah.
Have you ever been so tired that you want to puke and you're fighting for your life and you can barely breathe?
No.
That's where I was, man. I could barely breathe, and I wanted to puke, and these dudes are surrounding me, and I'm sitting here like, fuck you, you know? And at this moment, this guy pulls off of the road and pulls up and starts honking his horn. He's like, I'm a cop. You're all under arrest, you know, and all this shit. And these dudes scatter. They run to their cars. They're picking each other up because, hey, we were fucking doing some damage, right? Well, they take off. We're there still. My friend Shane's passed out. I thought he was dead. I'm trying to wake him up. There's a crowd. This is right in front of a Pier 1.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. There's a kind of crowd of people.
You're not like on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
You're like in town.
Right. Right. And wow. This group of people are sort of looking at us, and I said, could someone please call an ambulance?
Yeah.
You know? And they sort of snap out
Isn't
of it.
Isn't that wild, though, about like, because I've seen a couple, I've never been involved in any kind of big brawl like that, but I've seen a couple happen, and people just freeze.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people don't do anything.
No.
And there's like one person eventually that comes in and is like, hey, somebody do something. But it's wild how people just freeze.
Yeah. Well, it's just so far out there.
Yeah.
And they don't know what to do. And they could get hurt. I mean, let's face it. These dudes were animals.
The gun was never discharged.
No. No. Thank God. But check it out. So we go to the hospital. And by the way, they cut one. I remember one of these guys was slashing at my face, and I barely dodging it, and it sliced my ear. I thought it cut my ear off. And, I mean, blood's just running down from 100 different cuts, you know. But we go to the hospital. I'm 17. I'm in pediatrics. My parents are in jazz festival and can't be reached. Couldn't get painkillers. And they're x-raying my hands because they're so swollen.
Yeah.
And a nurse walks in, and I'm telling the police officer, this 100% happened. I'm telling the police officer, I could barely remember any of these guys' faces, but I remember that guy that I first hit with the cut. And I'm sitting there saying, I hit this guy, you know, blah, blah. A nurse walks in and goes, officer, three guys have just been beaten up in a fight came in. One of them's got a big cut over his eye. And it turns out that it was three of these dudes that had to go to the hospital too. And they got arrested in the hospital. We got our stitches, and we got to our senior prom. And I remember,
did they let you go because you were underage or what?
Well, I mean, they didn't charge us for anything because we didn't have any weapons. We were, you know, we were sitting there like.
Was the guy that pulled over and said he was a cop, was he really a cop?
No, wasn't a cop.
He was just.
He just saw what was going on and decided to interject. I mean, thank God. And, you know, the thing about it was, though, is, and this will tell you just how fucked up I really was as a human being. See. In my world, I could not show any weakness ever, ever. And so when someone was, I'm at prom, everyone knows what's happened. I've got cuts all over my body. I mean, hundreds of stitches or whatever. And they say, you know what I said? Now I know knives can't kill me. But I'd never felt so fragile in my life. Because in my world, if I said, hey, I need to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
I'm fucked up. Then I would have been a pussy.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? That's how disconnected I was from myself.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And from other people, man.
Yeah.
And do you know what I did? The next day, I was with my wrestling coach. He was kind of like a father to me at the time. And he said, Josh, you got the world by the balls. You should write a list of things to do before you die. And I'd never heard of anything like that. Now they call it a bucket list, which sort of offends me because it's so generic. Yeah. But I wrote out this list of things to do before I die, and I wanted to be this Renaissance man, learn to surf, travel the world, you know, nail a perfect 10, read the Bible, you know, learn archery, whatever you could think of that was masculine and manly.
I
wrote it down. And do you know the thing was, man, that whole list, I carried that list around in my pocket for like 15 years. It was all taped together. Yeah. Do you realize, like, that list was really just a list of things to do that I felt like I had to do to be worthy.
Like a list of insecurities.
To be worthy of life.
Yeah.
Of
no, I've been there. I was talking to somebody earlier about how we were talking about pro athletes and some people that we know that are like really high stature people, but they have insecurities in other place. Mm-hmm. And we kind of talked about that a little bit because I talked about even in racing, I think I'm a pretty day to day. I think I'm a pretty relaxed, like chill dude. And I'm a very happy person now.
You are. Compared to when I first met you, you're like
isn't it wild?
Dude.
Yeah.
Remember when I saw you in front of the elevator and you just had like your surgery and stuff and your head was shaved.
Dude, pre-surgery, like the 6 months.
You were like, hey.
Like the year to 6 months pre-surgery was just it was probably some of like the hardest time in my life because I was so anxious about everything. Sure. I was afraid. I had like real anxiety. But after it's the crazy thing about it is right after surgery, like literally right when I woke up, I haven't had any anxiety since at all. And it was like the wildest thing.
Dude, I mean, look, this might be out there for some people, but my personal belief, I'm sitting here playing with your dog.
Yeah, so the listeners are used to hearing Abe.
Okay.
Everybody knows.
So everyone knows that you've got a giant-ass horse for a dog.
Yeah, Abe hits mic stands. Abe will grab a squeaky toy. What happens is he does this to people because he likes the attention. This is Abe's insecurities. He wants the attention.
Right.
And then in like 10 minutes, if we just ignore him, he'll go lay down and he'll pass out somewhere. But he does this pretty much every show. Oh, there you go.
He's okay. A good dog, man.
He is a pretty good dude. But he loves being around people. But my point is, literally ever since I woke up, zero anxiety. But I think too, we have these insecurities, and I see it much more now than I used to. It used to be that I just wasn't capable of seeing it, but I think a lot of times...
Scott, you let a lot of stuff go is what really happened.
Yeah. Oh, fuck yeah, for sure.
And that's what I was going to say is, see, I think all sickness, cancer, things of that nature, really what it is we store this emotional pain in our bodies. I mean, think of it.
Do you think that has anything to do with like the physical creation of the sickness?
Yeah. Of course I do, because look, see, how many years, let's just say, one single memory, how many years has one single memory been torturing you?
Yeah, I mean,
right?
I don't have a whole, yeah, sure, go ahead. I mean, but I get your point, yeah.
See, feelings are embedded in memories.
Right.
And when you remember that memory, you feel the feeling associated with it. And people that have lived their lives in whatever fashion have accumulated all of these painful memories that they try to suppress and repress or express.
Right.
And they never really let go the way you did after your surgery. You let go of a lot of stuff, whatever it was. I mean, and it doesn't even have to be a memory necessarily, but it can be the way you view yourself, the way you think other people view you, the way you feel about something you did in the past. I mean, whatever it is, right? These painful emotions, we store them. And I think that's what most sickness comes from.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy because I have...
Joyful people are healthy. Joyful people can eat whatever they want and they don't get fat. Joyful people, I mean, they have no stress because they're joyful. You know, I've been on both sides of the spectrum, man. And I can tell you, like, at my most happy, joyful times, I was ripped. I could eat whatever I wanted. I had boundless energy. Didn't matter. And that's been proven by science now, where your body will actually discard the things that it doesn't need or can't use, like sugars and, you know, fats or whatever, and takes the nutrients that it does need when it's joyful. But when you're bogged down with negative emotion, bogged down with negative thought processes, or bogged down with not feeling worthy enough, you become sick. People become sick.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some of that I subscribe to for sure. I mean, I think living...
Scott, it could even be you feel guilty about having a privileged life. It could be anything.
Yeah, I mean, I for sure agree with the principle that stress affects our bodies in a, you know, almost purely negative way.
You need a little splash over there,
yeah, buddy. Yeah. But, okay, I want to hear more about, okay, so you were... You're at prom. You've just been through this traumatic experience.
Right.
Lead me into kind of like the days and even like years after, like through the next stage of your life or how that...
So after this all goes down, I'm traumatized. I'm so disconnected. See,
but you never talked to anybody about it.
Yeah, no. See, here's the thing. That image of ourselves, if it's... And I believe this... And the gulf, the space between who you really are, the real you,
right,
versus this image, yeah, right? The greater the distance, the more the suffering. And in my case, I was so disconnected, I couldn't even tell my dad this shit. I told my dad the same thing. Now I know knives can't kill me. I said that to my father, who I should be able to tell anything
was
to.
Was your dad, was he a supportive guy?
That's the thing, I mean... I know my dad was dealing with his own stuff, but he wasn't a very good father. You know, he wasn't a loving father. He wasn't kind. He was angry.
Right.
You know, he didn't start showing up to my wrestling matches until I started winning, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think there are a lot, you know, I feel really, really lucky in that way, in that my dad, like, killed himself through life and to just pay the bills. And but he, if there was something that was important to me or my brother or sister, he always found a way to be there. But the reason I really asked the question is because my dad is one of the kindest, most loving people that I've ever met in my life. But it's only in like these last 10 to 15 years as the children have become adults, excuse me, that he has become comfortable with showing emotion.
Loving.
And I think a lot of our parents, you know, the generation that we are, a lot of our parents come from a generation of transition and... and they don't, you know, they're not great at showing emotion because they're still part of the generation where push it down, hide it.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, we've only recently gotten to a point with our generation where we're like, let's talk about this stuff and let's be open about it and let's find solutions. And they were never like that.
Right. So there's a few things. Have you heard of Malcolm Gladwell?
Yeah. Yeah. I just listened to a podcast with him, last week. Absolutely.
So he describes the South in particular as being a culture of honor. And really what that stems from is like the Scottish, Irish influence where if someone disrespected you, you had to fight them.
Right.
And sometimes you had to kill them. Well, that's sort of how the South is still sort of rolls, right? And part of the byproduct of that is showing emotion is just not masculine.
Right.
It's just not masculine. And so your father is in that era where they struggled to have that sort of that that softness, because being loving was considered weak. Being affectionate was not necessarily strong, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of my father is that way. He thinks John Wayne or something is like his archetype person, a guy that shows no emotion.
Yeah.
My father doesn't show very much emotion.
Yeah.
And he'd be upset with me for saying this about him. But
well, my dad's the same way. Like I wouldn't say he's super affectionate, but I've never ever questioned whether my dad loved me.
Right.
We never really had any, it wasn't until I was in college that we had any, we were on the level where we could have serious conversations.
Yeah.
We, you know, I always had most of that stuff with my mom, but I think, you know, his dad was a colossal piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
He was like a drunk, you know, they very blue collar family, no money. And so I think that my dad, to his own credit, was very cognizant of not being that, but he was still, until a certain age or a certain level of our relationship as his children, he was still never really show a whole lot of emotion.
Yeah.
And he's still a pretty quiet guy, but now he's much more open about, he's very emotional now.
Yeah, sure.
And he's super sweet. Our generation, meaning mine and yours, and the generation before us, our parents, it's like this interesting curve of societal change of being able to show and be comfortable with emotion.
Yeah, and it's also a matter of expanded consciousness, really.
Right.
You know, where you see people as human beings instead of, you know, people you have to compete against,
yeah,
or fight for resources over, or, you know, they're another human being instead of just person over there, you know, kind of a thing. And to your point, your dad, my father, you know, they're guys that they were being the way they thought they had to be. That's how all of this works.
Right.
Everybody is being the way
they weren't dreamers. They were just doers because that's what had to happen.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know,
for sure.
You know, and we're sort of out here trying to pick up the pieces and fit it all together because, you know, like you said something to me the other night when we were done hanging out, you said, "I love you, man." And you know, when I was growing up, friends did not say that to each other.
Oh yeah.
They didn't say that to each other.
But I'm also super, I don't just go throwing that around.
No, of course not.
But people that I feel, people that like, I think maybe
it's sincere. You're sincere, but what I'm trying to say is, even if you felt that way about another man,
it's very rare
for anyone to have ever said. I mean, think about how guys hug each other.
Yeah,
what happens first? They have to give the bro handshake,
yeah,
right?
Shake, yeah.
And then they hug each other with the arm wrapped around with the hands in between you,
yeah,
because there's a little bit of a barrier,
yeah,
right? But why is that? Because men are not comfortable fully embracing each other with both arms.
Yeah. It's funny because I usually play it out. I usually let the dude come to me first, and I see, like, is he going to offer me the hand? Because if it's up to me, I'm just going to go in for a hug. Like,
right.
I don't give a shit about this. Like,
right.
Especially if we know each other deeper than a handshake.
Yeah.
Like, just give me a fucking hug. But I've learned that not everybody's like that.
And
I let people, I let them offer what they want first,
right,
and then I'll go from there. It's like, are we doing the shake and pull hug, or are we just going to fucking hug it out?
Right, right. See, but think about what that really means on a deeper level.
Yeah.
Men are uncomfortable with that kind of affection, giving and receiving it.
Right.
But think about how sad that really is, going through your life unable to express out of fear the emotions that you really feel about the people dear to you.
Yeah.
And that's how most men live, man, in fear.
You know, it's crazy. I've thought about this a lot, and I don't know if we've ever really, maybe I've talked about this with a couple people, but our friends group here, if you think about the different lives that we have all lived, for the most part, our group came together, and I'm talking about the guys here, as alpha males.
Sure.
Like we talk, if we look at the different, we're all sort of like guys,
at the top of our little distinctive niches.
We're all alphas. But the crazy part about that is to me that we have never had any issues as a group of guys. Like we all gelled together quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We all look out for each other. And I think that speaks to, we attracted each other, man. That's how we all were. Yeah, yeah. I'm really, really interested in emotional intelligence. I thrive off of it.
Right.
And I think that no matter what we all do in our daily lives, we all possess that trait in commonality. And
to your point, so marriages. I think more marriages would be so much more successful if men didn't have to ask their wives for permission to hang out with their friends.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Men need to be around men sometimes. Men need to be able to hang out and do guy shit. And it should be something that's okay. It shouldn't be like, I'm worried you're going to go cheat on me because you're with those guys. No, it should be something that's like, go ahead and go and be around the people that you're close to. But that doesn't happen anymore, man. And you know what's the worst part? Is like, a lot of my married friends, they don't want to deal with the drama that ensues for saying, hey, I want to go hang out with Josh because Josh is a single guy. Josh bangs
You know what's crazy, though? I'll say this, though, and this is another compliment I think on our group is that this is the first like tight-knit group of guy friends that I've had where that's not an issue.
Right.
When people come to know the guys that are in the group and I say, I'm just going to hang out with the dudes tonight. Like they don't.
Cause the guys aren't going to put up with that shit. These dudes that we're hanging with are like, no, that's how it is. I mean, you should accept that. This is important to me.
Well, I think my point is more to like, I think they know that when I'm going out with the dudes, like they know and like the quality of guys that I'm with.
Sure.
I think there were points in my life where girls that I've dated have not enjoyed the quality of people that I'm hanging out with, and maybe rightly so, maybe not.
Right.
But this is just such a quality group of people that I can't speak for anybody else, but I haven't had that issue since I've been here, especially with the group, because it's like individually, even despite all of our separate vices, like all of the dudes that we hang out with here are just general good fucking humans.
They are good human beings, man, and we're lucky. You know, meeting you guys under the circumstances that I did, it came at the moment. And that's another thing I'm starting to see now that I've sort of expanded my consciousness and started coming from a place of love and things like that, is that rather than attracting conflict, I attract these sort of relationships with people that I resonate with. You know? And that's kind of, I mean, you've heard it before probably, like your vibe attracts your tribe kind of a thing. And we just all happen to be more or less on the same kind of level where, you know, we're all at this place in our lives where we want to build something, where we're respectful, where, you know, we're not interested in having conflict, but we don't want turmoil. We want to build something. We want to grow.
Right.
And so, you know, I could go on and on, but it's special what we all somehow stumbled upon in this crazy building. You know?
It is. I've lived in a lot of different buildings, but this is the tightest knit family group I've ever had.
Yeah.
And I'm a little afraid to move out because I'm afraid to lose that.
Well, I just did, as you know. And let me just tell you something. You do feel disconnected. I miss y'all. Like, you know, this, for the people listening, I decided to buy this little bungalow.
Josh bought a house.
Finally recovered from the 2008 financial crisis and bought another house. But it's kind of like, it's different, man. You know, you got to fix your own bullshit, first of all, calling somebody. And then the other thing is like, your friends just, you know, anytime you want, you can hit somebody up and say, hey, what are you doing? You know, let's hang. And I don't really have that luxury anymore, or at least I feel a little disconnected.
Well, and I think that's the thing too, because it's crazy because where you move like less than a mile away, less than 2 miles away, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, but I agree. You know,
Well, it's not the same thing as being able to walk down and say, you're hey, right. man. Like, remember when I was like, hey, do you have a couple of wine glasses I could borrow?
You're right. No, you're totally right. But also, when I get real about it, I would drive over there. You know, I mean, it's...
I just wanted the place to be set up before you guys come over, to be honest with you. I've still got to do some painting and some other stuff. But, yeah, y'all are going to come. Don't worry.
It's going to be dope.
Yeah.
We should do an episode there one night.
I'd love that.
We should do like an all guys episode at your place one night.
I'd love that, man. You know, I mean, I don't know who our target audience is yet, but whoever's listening is going to really get some benefit out of some of our guy talk. I can guarantee you.
I think I've already found out, not even just the guy talk, when I had Rachel on, you know, we got into some pretty controversial stuff.
Yeah.
And people were very, that, you know, a lot of people have had really good things to say so far about what we've been doing, but because I think it's real, but I think a lot of people are also a little polarized by it, which I love. Anything that sparks conversation, I'm into it.
Yeah.
You know, because like, well, that's what that discussion, whether right or wrong. And I will have to say this, we had a little bit to fact check myself last time. We had a conversation about the whole maternal instinct thing. And somebody called me out on that after listening to the podcast. And we had a conversation about it, and I went and I did some research on it, and I found out that, okay, well, we were a little bit wrong too. But so were they, because they said that maternal instinct has been disproved completely by science. Well, yes, but what I discovered was when tests were done on oxytocin levels, it levels out eventually. But the crazy thing about it is the female almost always still experiences that before the male, even if the male is injected. Because all these tests have been done with lab rats, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was they were injecting the lab rats with oxytocin, which is a thing. But females develop that naturally before we do. Mm. So, but the point about that is that's what I love about this, is it creates discussion, and I think you know, and most of the people that are close to me know that I yearn for knowledge. That's why I love people's stories on this show, because it's real stuff, and I learn new things about the people that I love or people that I'm interested in.
Well, to that point, so, and my personal story, you asked what happened to me after.
So we still got a lot to get through. So we're gonna have to say
that's okay. But so, you know, I wrote this list of things to do before I die, and one of the things on there was become an Army Ranger or Navy SEAL.
Yep, which is a great segue because that's where I was gonna go next.
Yeah, cool. Yep. Well,
let's go there.
So I decided to become an Army Ranger because it was only a 4-year commitment.
Right.
And the Navy SEAL was a 6-year commitment, yeah. Right? And so the last thing I needed was, at this point in my life, after being traumatized so much, was to go and be screamed at. But that's exactly what I chose to do. And I wound up, you know, becoming a Ranger in 2nd Battalion. And it was just this crazy whole thing. And, I mean, I thought I was tough, right?
Right.
But I had never experienced that kind of tough. I mean, wrestling is hard.
Right.
But being tired, being without sleep, without anything to eat, blisters all over your feet and back, and you got to go another 12 miles.
Where was your boot camp at?
That was in Georgia, Fort Benning, which is where all the infantry training takes place. Including airborne school
entire Army trains there.
The infantry does.
The infantry. Okay.
You're
just to be
on the ground fighters type guys.
Right.
Right.
And just to be transparent, I didn't serve. So a lot of these, cause I was asking Travis some questions about his service, and I don't know, but I want to know more. So
Travis says something along the lines of the regular Marine is is equivalent to an Army Ranger, and that's not true. I was kind of laughing at that. But look, not that Marines aren't tough as balls, but Rangers are the most elite unit in the world as far as light infantry is concerned. And again, that's something I felt like I had to do to prove that I was worthy of whatever.
How old were you when you went in?
18.
18.
Yeah.
Right after 18. High school.
Right. Right.
And could you have wrestled in college?
Well, let me tell you. So
I don't want to derail you.
No. Check it out. It's to your question. So I came back from a mission in Panama, and there was a wrestling tournament on the base in Fort Lewis, Washington. And I thought, wow, I'll just do this for fun. And I won it. Freestyle. Never wrestled freestyle
in
my life.
Is that where you were stationed?
Yeah. As in 2nd Ranger Battalion, I was at Fort Lewis, Washington. Yeah. And that's kind of a funny story. The way I wound up there was, see, I could have stayed in 3rd Battalion. There's only 3 Ranger Battalions in the country, and 2 of them are in Georgia. And my girlfriend at the time, I was crazy about her, Lexi. Crazy about her, man.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. And I had the choice to stay in Georgia, but I thought, if I don't go to Washington, I might never go. And if this girl's meant for me, we'll stay together.
Yeah.
And so I left, because my whole philosophy at that point was, I can always go back, might as well keep moving forward, right?
Yeah.
And so I went to Washington, and there I was.
I will say is what I love about you, because you're a very introspective person, but you're also, we share this trait, I think, and you can confirm or deny this, but we're kind of like balls to the wall when we want to do something.
Hey, man, there's only one way to go, you know? That's 100 miles an hour.
That's the thing that I think people, I don't know, maybe they do or don't get this for me, because I think sometimes I'm calm and I talk.
You're calm.
But I, mellow. Like,
go 100 miles an hour when you make a decision,
I'll
right?
I'll fucking go. Like, yeah. It's just no different than us jumping off those cliffs. Like,
Scott, when I really started liking you, man. When we started jumping off cliffs together. That was when I was like, I like this guy.
Dude,
because those other dudes were afraid.
I was
they wouldn't
always
do it.
The crash test dummy as a kid.
It was us going first, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, so let's talk about that more. But so there I was, man, and I won this wrestling tournament.
Yeah.
And the director said, hey, guess what? Now you get to try out for the All-Army team, and if you make it, all you're going to do is wrestle.
Oh, shit.
And I was like,
you were going to be fucking Forrest Gump.
Bro, I was the Forrest Gump
of wrestling,
man. I'm telling you. So, look, check it out. My first sergeant, that's the guy that was in charge of us, didn't want me to go, like, was trying to block me from leaving.
Because you were probably a badass on his, like, you know,
well, yeah,
his team.
I was a tough guy in the Ranger Battalion, you know, and I was kicking it. I didn't like it. I never liked it. This was shit I thought I had to do to be worthy of whatever, right? Yeah. I didn't really want to be a soldier. That's just some shit I felt like I had to do. Well, so there I am. I want to go to this wrestling thing because that's going to be cool. And I'm this 2-time state champion, and I'm going to make this team. I had no idea. I got permission to go somehow. I show up, and I had never been beaten up so bad in my life because, see, the Army has what's called the World Class Athlete Program. And it's actually people that are Olympic caliber athletes that train for the Army and get a paycheck for it. And yeah, they're in the Army, but they're not really in the Army.
They never serve. They never really serve.
Not really.
They're never deployed.
No. They stay on this team doing their respective sports.
Yeah,
you know,
they're figureheads.
Like, right.
Yep.
I mean, it's a recruitment tool. And so
let me ask you this, just real quick. Isn't that like the band?
Right. You could say it's like the band, right? Like they're more
I'm not comparing the skill set, but it's the same type of.
Yeah, they're not really soldiers.
Figureheads. They're there for motivation.
They're not really going out and doing soldiering. Yeah. They're out there doing like.
They're like the Captain Americas.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, I go and it's like it wound up being like a 6-month long tryout. And this guy, Derek Waltrip, who's an Olympian, said, this guy's got potential. See, normally what they do is they recruit these guys straight out of, like, after they graduate college. They're all Americans. They're national champions, you know, whatever.
They want the guys with a proven
record.
Right,
right. Yeah. I'm 19 at this point in my life.
Yeah.
I'm from Alabama, which is a shitty wrestling state.
Yeah.
But I made that wrestling team, man. And I wound up placing 4th in Olympic trials with 2 years of training Greco-Roman wrestling.
That's crazy.
I can't believe I did that. See, I thought I sucked, Scott. See, I thought I wasn't any good. And I can't believe, I beat guys. I can't believe some of the guys that I beat. But in my mind, I was still this kid from Georgia that was poor and not worth anything.
That's wild, dude.
Yeah. So I can't believe what
this is crazy because, and I think it's relevant because of A, your story and B, last weekend. So you were with me when we watched the fights last weekend, and we watched Max Holloway fight the Australian guy.
Yeah, and
that fight was all. Would you agree that all the fights we watched were just killer?
Yeah, they were great.
Probably
fights.
The best card of the week. Great fights. Okay. So if you don't follow UFC, Max Holloway fought. It was the featherweight belt. Max Holloway has held it for. He's held off several challenges. I don't know how many, but he's like considered the best featherweight of all time, basically. And he fought this Australian guy last weekend, and the guy, basically, it was neck and neck, but they gave, what I've learned since, they ended up giving the guy the win off of how much he wore Max's leg out on the kicks. Because this guy was just throwing hitch kicks that were just wearing Max's leg out.
He had a lot more strikes than Holloway did.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Well, like actually, that interesting thing is the strike count was really close, but they gave the guy more points because they felt like his leg kicks
were more effective.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is I was listening to Joe Rogan today. Joe, the day after, this past weekend, Joe interviewed Max. And Max is also a super humble guy. He was like, he came in, he was prepared, I got beat, whatever. But the thing that I think relates to you is you talk about being this guy from Alabama that's like a nobody and you don't know anything, and you came in there and you did this great thing.
Right.
Max was talking about when he got his first UFC contract, it was like a two-month camp. He had no real coaches, no nutritionists. Mm-hmm. He was in Hawaii where fucking nobody lives out there as far as UFC coaches.
Right.
Listen to this. This is going to blow your mind. After knowing how good Max Holloway is now, how much of a skilled striker he is, for his first two UFC fights, he trained. He would go to the gym, and he would roll like with the people that he rolled with, and he would strike with the people that he striked with just in his local gym. He would go home at night, and he would get his not even a coach, but the guy that would hold his mitts, the guy that he would do mitt practice with, they would play the UFC video game, and Max would be Jose Aldo. And Max would watch the way that Jose would fight in the game, and then the next day when they would go to practice, Max would be like, remember in the game when I did this thing and Jose's body rolled out? Because they had replicated, at least they thought at this time, they had replicated Jose's movement so well that they would fight each other at night in the video game. They would literally go home and play video games.
This is the power of visualization.
Isn't that crazy? Max Holloway learned how to fight off of the UFC video game. How crazy is that?
Honestly.
And also similar to what you, like.
Right.
Wow, fucking bananas, dude. Come on.
You know, man, honestly, this doesn't surprise me to hear this because this is one of the powers we all as human beings possess. We can visualize things and it becomes real.
Yeah.
We just have to believe. That's all it takes.
That's just wild. Because I don't know where he is now as far as his belt levels.
Yeah.
But we all agree that
He's a fantastic
best
fighter.
Featherweight of all time.
Yeah.
But fucker learned how to fight off of the UFC video game and literally just had that much natural skill and heart. Wild.
Right. I mean, those are other elements that
wild,
you can't
dude.
Teach. Having heart, you can't teach that. Having desire, can't teach
but
that.
But that's my point about you coming in against all these fucking All-Americans.
Yeah.
This is one of the stories that I love the most. I've just recently, like in the last probably year, learned this about you. But this is one of the things that I enjoy the most is because I think I talk about this all the time with people in racing.
Mm.
And they say, well, you know, like what makes a racing driver? And I say, well, actually, and this is because I'm a very analytical, mathematical person. I think, I truly believe this, that in a car, that you and I could, if we both started from zero, you and I could go spend 2 weeks to a month at a driving school, and we could technically learn how to be just as skilled. We could come out of there being perfectly even on the skill level. The difference that makes the higher level, and by high level, I mean probably like the top 2,000 guys in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we say, you know,
And that's a small number considering there's 7 billion people in the world. There's probably 2,000 to 3,000 top-level drivers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Those top-level people, it's not that they have any more technical skill than anybody, because I believe that can be learned. The difference is it's that killer instinct.
Yeah.
It's when you are 100%. Going side by side into a left-hand 90-degree turn and you have to shove that car in there, it's the guys that have the gumption to do that. That is the dudes that like make it and rise to the top. And it's the same thing with what you're talking about.
So I can tell you from firsthand experience, I can't say that I was ever like at your level of driving, right? But I love driving my car. And I go to Las Vegas from here in Phoenix.
Also, you have a badass car.
Thank you. Thank you. I love that car.
Josh drives a BMW 7 Series Alpina. This is very, if you're a car guy.
It's Alpina B7. This motherfucker flies.
It's a beautiful car.
It has 500 horsepower.
Yeah, it's sick.
So,
it's probably the most capable, one of the most capable big body sedans of all time.
I love this car, man. Yeah. And so I was driving, when I go to Las Vegas,
oh, it's great.
I mean, I don't know how, drive. Like 50-something miles of nothing but just freeway and no cops or anything around, right?
Oh, yeah.
You can open it up.
Yeah, you can.
And so what has happened to me on more than one occasion is, like, you run into someone else that wants to fly, too. Yeah. And so I wound up getting into it with this guy who had an M5 BMW, which is a very powerful
what
car.
What year M5? Was it a V8 or V10?
It was a 2014, but I think it had more V8. Horsepower than mine. It's a lighter car, right?
Yeah. But, well, because they had, sorry, it doesn't matter. But.
Well, yeah, but what you're saying is exactly right. See, I didn't hesitate. I knew to go. And this guy just didn't have the same, well, I'm going to go ahead and say, he didn't have the balls. Balls, even though he had the faster car, and I was beating him every single time when we would wind up doing this stuff. And we pull over, you know, and we met and stuff and everything. He's like, man, I don't understand. Like, he felt bad about it. Like, he thought his car wasn't performing, but I knew what was going on or whatever. But yeah, to your point,
he didn't have it in him.
It's exactly right.
Yeah.
It's exactly right. Like, you can't teach that. You either got or you don't. And so that's what's so crazy about my whole life was, see, it wasn't, if people could tap into doing what they want out of joy, out of joy instead of lower emotions like fear. See, I moved on the basis of fear. When wrestling and stuff, I was afraid. I just wanted so badly to be somebody. And so that's what was going on with me. But if I had just been joyful, carefree, training because I loved it, competing because I loved it, I'd have gone so much further. And that same thing when fighting. See, I was on the Ultimate Fighter. You know who I lost? My whole life would have been different if I had won this fight. I was on season 7 of the Ultimate Fighter. It's the first season where they said, surprise reality twist, you have to fight to stay in the house this year. See, I showed up injured, sick. I didn't want to pass up the opportunity. And I got paired up with a guy named Matt Brown, who's one of the toughest motherfuckers.
Like, yeah, he's a badass.
He's a tough motherfucker. I mean, skill-wise, I mean, debatable as far as, like, how great he is. He's a great, he's a skillful fighter, but toughness?
Yeah.
I mean, he's one of the toughest motherfuckers on the planet.
Yeah, he's still fighting.
Yeah, he's still fighting, and that was since, that was, let me think, 2007?
Yeah.
2007, this guy's still fighting. You get kicked.
Wait, didn't he fight, didn't Matt fight?
He just fought Ben Saunders.
Prelims.
He just fought Ben Saunders. I don't know who won that fight. I was curious about that.
I think, I don't remember who won either, but I know he fought last weekend in the prelims, I think.
Yeah, he fought Ben Saunders, man.
Yeah.
And but I went up against him, and see, I knew I had maybe 5 minutes in the tank at best. I hadn't trained in 3 or 4 weeks, which is a lifetime in fighting. But
how many fights did you get on that show?
Just the one.
Just the one.
Just the one. Just the one. And as a matter of fact, they wanted me to come back on it because they kicked another guy off, but I was injured.
Yeah.
I was injured, and I just you know, I couldn't do it. My back was just too hurt.
That's crazy.
Yeah. My whole life would have been different if I'd have won that fight.
Well, but I think, like, we all have, I've had times like that before where I've lost rides. I've lost, you know, like, season-long race rides off of just silly things, silly timing things, not even things that, you know, I don't know. It's weird. The world is weird. I think no matter what you're in, especially when you're in such a highly competitive and highly challengeable position as that.
Yeah.
You know, if you can't, and that's the problem. That's why people.
Well, there's luck, right? Luck,
yeah.
Luck plays a big part of it. The injuries you have, the things that go on, the whatever happens, the opportunity. But see, I think you also attract what you feel you're worthy of. And when I was down there operating from a place of fear, you know, as I said before, you don't heal as fast. You don't recover. You don't feel good. It's not something you want to do, you know. And so if I had been able to tap into joy, I just love this shit.
Yeah.
I just want to compete. You know, I would have gone so much further, but I wasn't able to back then.
Yeah.
Because, see, my self-limiting beliefs, what I thought I was worthy of, wouldn't permit it. And that applies to everybody.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be fighting. It could be where they are in any job,
yeah,
any place in their life. What they feel they're worthy of is what they're attracting all the time.
For sure. Because when I went back to get my master's degree, I was, I was almost 30. Mm-hmm. I wasn't like the old guy, but I was older. And the difference was when I got in there, and I'm only making this comparison because usually I would say something about racing, but the only reason that I was the upper hand that I had is, but I would get in that class and I would say, all these younger kids would be stressing out about everything. And I would be like, man, this is pretty easy. Like all right. I have to do is show up and do the work and I can kind of fucking kill it.
Right.
You know? And that made me really successful in that part of my life. And that's just insight that I could have never had as a younger person, ever.
Belief,
yeah.
Confidence. Belief is the biggest key. You asked me if I could have wrestled in college. Well, see, I placed fourth in Olympic trials in Greco.
Yeah.
And after I got out of the Army, I went to the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, and I was living there for a little bit. I got recruited to Oklahoma State, and Arizona State, by the way, which was at the time the greatest wrestling school in the country.
OSU is still a big wrestling school, right? Isn't it OSU, Iowa?
OSU, Iowa, Pennsylvania,
yeah.
Place like that. But see, I went to scholarship on there, but I was just so unhappy, and I left, and that's how I moved to California. I really said to myself, you know what? If I'm going to be unhappy, I'm going to be in the sunshine. So yeah. I moved to California.
Well, that's one of the things I say about here. People are like, you know, how do you like it out there? And I said,
I wish I'd gone to Arizona State, though, man.
Do you?
Yeah. Yeah, those guys have a great time.
It wasn't because of the girls?
I mean, that's the other thing. Man, there's beautiful women in Arizona.
Yeah.
Beautiful women. It's wild.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of beautiful women out here. Okay, so I want to know, how did you, this is, I think, an interesting thing. How did you come from being this military fighting pedigree, wrestling, you know, hard-built Southern guy to being kind of like the ethereal intellectual that you are now? Because I would say you're a very life curious, you're a compassionate guy.
Mm.
You're very open about like your flaws and being emotional. And at some point you had to have that realization that that's an exploration that you wanted to take. So guide me through that process. And I want to know everything, you know, you can like touch on the high level stuff or the key points if you want, but you know, I've never known anybody, you know, you always hear stories about people like, oh, this person just decided they were going to go do this and they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done some things like that in my life that people definitely called me crazy for, but like your trip to Bali, you know, I want to hear about that. I want to hear about just that whole transformation into your life because I feel like I can see a little bit of the guy that you talk about being as a younger person, but you're clearly not that person now. So guide me through that is what I want.
Okay. So the short answer is I had a spiritual awakening. But before that, see, I was carrying around, and this is how I think it is for everybody. See, the image of ourselves. It represents everything we think we're worthy of.
Right.
And it represents all of our self-limiting beliefs. It's the way we think we have to be to navigate. It's supposed to protect us and get us what we want. And the thing about it is, and I was like this, see, if I had finally gotten to a point where if I didn't know something about a subject, I would shut up.
Yeah.
But if I knew something, you couldn't tell me I was wrong.
Right.
And if you were going to tell me that I didn't know about my own reality, I was going to tell you to go fuck yourself. See, I was being the way everyone is. They think they have to be a certain way.
Right.
Right. And so this image, it's what we put all of our mental power into all the time. And it's like a magnet. It attracts all these events to keep supporting its existence. And in mine, if it didn't have conflict, then it had no reason to exist because it was supposed to protect me, remember?
Right.
And so over the course of my life, I brought in some really horrible shit, man. I mean, stuff where I can't believe I got through it. I mean, that stuff with the knives wasn't even close to the worst thing.
Right.
And see, when I came to Phoenix...
What do you consider worse than that? You don't have to tell me the actual thing, but what do you consider...
I was falsely accused of sexual assault. And it was during a period where you don't question a woman because why would they ever lie about something so serious?
Right.
Zero evidence against me, didn't matter. I was arrested for that, and it played out over a two-year period.
Yeah.
Where my appointed attorney wouldn't even call me back. I thought I was going to prison.
Yeah.
And I wound up going to a trial, and they actually came to me at the most vulnerable point, and they said, here's your plea bargain. First time I'd been offered a plea bargain.
Yeah.
If you plead guilty to a misdemeanor C, harassment, then you'll get to go. There's no jail time.
Yeah.
There's no sex offender status, and you can just pay a fine and go on with your life. And at this point in my life, I'd had misdemeanors before.
Yeah.
I'd been in fights. I'd hurt people. And that was no big deal. And I was so tired after 2.5 years waiting on this trial because it's all I thought about, man.
Right.
Every day, every single day, every moment. And the moments I would forget about it for brief instances, then I'd remember it again. It'd come back and crush me. You know, you might go to prison. And they never took my passport.
Yeah.
I was traveling the world. Yeah. I was trying to have the best time I possibly could.
Yeah.
Before this thing happened to me, you know? And so they came to me and they said this, and I was this close to taking it.
Right.
But then my friends started showing up in the courtroom, and my family walks in, and I see them, and I said, Jesus Christ, if I take this deal,
yeah,
then they're always going to wonder if I really did it
or not. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so I told my attorney, I said, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
And he's like, Josh, this is as good as it can possibly get. And I just looked at him. I said, Chris, I'm not saying I did it. And I don't know what clicked in his head, man, but he started walking this fine line between not being too tough on her when he was questioning her,
right,
but not letting her get away with anything either.
Right.
And she started to crumble on the stand. And I was exonerated. And so that was probably one of the hardest things I'd ever gone through. And the worst part is, man, 2 weeks afterwards, I was high on being free. But then I was miserable again.
Yeah.
I was unhappy because that persona, that, you know, image of myself. See, you always think you have to be more of something, more, more. And I had gotten to a point where, see, I attracted all of that, and including the knife thing. And so at this point in my life, I left Las Vegas and I moved down to Phoenix with one of my best friends to start over, just to have a different perspective. And really, in my mind, I was kind of suicidal, Scott. See, I wasn't happy. And I'd been with women of every persuasion. I'm a good-looking guy. I've traveled the world. But I was miserable.
Ladies, Josh is a very good-looking. He's the best-looking guy of our group,
but
if we can be honest.
I was miserable, man, because Because, see, I was being something that I wasn't. I was disconnected from the man I really am.
Yeah.
And, because of that, I was also disconnected from everyone around me. And I thought I had to be this thing. See, I had gotten into fights, and I had been accused of sexual assault. And at this point, I wouldn't leave my apartment. I wouldn't get out. I didn't leave from, like, maybe two or three times for 2 years.
And so let's talk about – we'll talk about the depression part of that in a minute, because I think that's something that we both kind of share. But a point that I wanted to make, and I didn't want to, like, pull it out of you, but I wanted to – I'm glad that you brought it up, because I think me going through law school, one of the things that I – experienced, and I'm not a practicing attorney, but I went through this in some of the stuff that I did, and I think that we are, and very rightfully so, I think we are in a period where women's rights are taking a huge shift in the way that we think and we deal with that as a country. But there are still plenty of people out there that go after people in a false manner, guys and girls. Mm. And I think I've seen that firsthand. I've worked for the prosecution and I've worked for the defense. And I've seen it devastate families when people are falsely accused of things. Mm. I'm really thankful for you that you're open to talking about that, because I think it's a great story of overcoming something that was not put on you
in a deserving way. I forgive her. I understand this in a whole different way now. You see, everybody has this image, right? And so the dynamic with her and I was simply this. This came out in the trial. She was there waiting on another guy that she wound up dating for a year after this whole episode.
Right.
And she was seen leaving the bar with me. And we go out to this back alley and we're making out. And I'm like, come on, let's get out of here. And she's like, no, I can't. I'm still like, come on, let's go. And she said something dismissive to me. She said something to dismiss me. And see, this image of mine, I'm well traveled, I'm knowledgeable, I'm this, you know, I've got game, I'm a good looking guy, and you're dismissing me. You see, it threatened my identity.
Right.
And so I lashed out and said something ugly back to her. And so her identity was threatened. And in that moment, I walk away. I'm walking down the street. There happened to be three police officers just standing right across the street watching the whole affair take place.
Right.
And she ran up to those guys and said, I've never seen this guy before in my life. And he just shoved his hand down my pants. You see, what happened was, this is what I believe. Her identity was threatened. She wanted to be worthy of this guy that she liked affection. She wanted to teach me a lesson
right.
at the same time. She didn't want to be a slut or whatever. And in that moment, in that drunken, upset, emotional moment, she saw a way out. And check this out. See, when the cop approached me, remember, at this point in my life, not only do I have a don't fuck with me thing going on, but is I don't put up with anyone's shit ever. And that meant cops too. And this cop said, hey man, he walked up to me. He goes, what happened with the girl in the alley? And I look up at him and I'm like, the girl in the alley? Oh, it was a waste of my time. We just made out. He goes, well, she says you shoved your hand down her pants. And I look at the guy, go, that offended me, my little persona. Do I look like I need to fucking do that to someone? I've got game. I'm good looking. You know, how dare you accuse me of this shit? And I said to this cop, no, I fucking didn't.
Yeah.
And he looked at me. He goes, whoa, 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 stay calm and I won't arrest you. And that pissed me off more. I said, first of all, I am calm and no, I fucking didn't.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think happened? I offended his. I'm in charge here, motherfucker.
Right.
I'm a cop. Who do you think you're talking to? You big, arrogant, angry-looking dude. I'm going to show your ass who's in charge.
Yeah.
Up against the wall. I mean, what else was going to happen to me?
Yeah.
Really? You see, I played a role in everything that happened to me. It wasn't like I was some victim. I mean, for a year and a half, 2 years, I mean, really up until I turned, you know, I'll tell you about that, my spiritual awakening, I thought I had done nothing wrong and I was snatched off the street, and this is what's going on with this crazy feminism and all this other stuff. I'm an innocent man, but see, I played a role in it.
Yeah.
Everybody does. No one wants to be the everybody wants to be the victim. No one wants to be responsible. But if you look at everybody who's done anything, and they've always played a role in it, and they've told themselves these pretty little lies so they're not responsible. And so you were asking me how this all went down, how I figured it out. I'll tell you. About 3 months before I turned 40, I hadn't left my apartment in almost 2 years to do anything more than grocery shop because I was
really
scared shitless.
Here, where you live
in
here?
Yeah, here in Phoenix. If I go outside, if I go out to, say, Old Town, if I go to these places, I'm going to wind up getting to a fight with some motherfucker and hurting them and going to jail, or some girl's going to accuse me of some shit that I didn't do, and then I'm going to go to prison.
Right.
And I was living in fear, man. The big, tough guy that's fucking not scared shit. I was mortified. Anxiety through the roof. Because my thing wasn't serving me.
Yeah.
Really. And so, but I start, here I am about to turn 40 years old. And I kind of think, you know, I don't want to throw myself a birthday party. That seems really self-indulgent. But I want to see some of the people that I'm close to. See, in the past, like the past 5-6 years, I'd always been in some foreign country like Indonesia or Colombia or wherever, and I knew some people there, but I didn't have any history with them. It was like I had this party relationship with them, and Josh is a real cool guy, blah, 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 but they didn't know me. And so I reached out to this guy named David Rodriguez, who's had horrible shit happen to him. He's a ex-heavyweight champion boxer. I said, hey, Dave, I hadn't seen the guy in 8 years because, you know, when you have a don't fuck with me thing going on, you come into conflict with everybody. Right, so yeah. I hadn't seen this guy in 8 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, hey, man, I'm having a birthday party. I want you to come. He said, I'm there. I'm fucking there. And that sort of like emboldened me to ask other friends. Because, yeah. See, I had all these grandiose plans for myself, Scott. Because remember, I didn't feel worthy of love. So I had to do all this shit to do it. But I wasn't making any headway on these things. And so what I did was just sort of withdraw from people because I didn't have any great news to show up on all my plans.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But what wound up happening is 7 of some of my closest friends from different points in my life, different geographical locations, different periods, they all flew in to see me. And when I'm just going to go ahead and tell you, that night I'd taken a hit of acid. I'm rolling on ecstasy. I'm high on weed. I'm doing lines of blow. And somehow this perfect combination of drugs and love for my dear, dear friends, I start introducing each guy because it'd always been a dream for my best friends to know each other. These guys have heard stories about each other. They don't know each other. They're all legends in their own way, right?
Right, right.
I start introducing them, and I'm tripping on acid, not like stuff that I hadn't thought about and forever, didn't even realize I knew, starts coming up, and I start speaking about it. And, like, I start to appreciate these guys for real.
Yeah.
You see, because when you're driven, you're always thinking about some future destination, some future point where you've made this little agreement with your image that then I can be happy.
Right.
But I'm happy now, and these people are here for me. And all I want is for them to have a good time. And so I realized in that moment, I saw it. This is my image. And that's not fucking me.
Yeah.
It's not me. And I realized, I mean, really, what I really am is just a sexy beast. Yeah. Yeah. I was wearing I was wearing a 3-piece peach linen suit out, man. And you see, in Old Town, can you imagine, like, see, I always dress kind of crazy like that, right?
Yeah.
Always got
I appreciate, to be honest.
Someone's always got some shit to say to me about it, right?
Yeah.
Always. But do
you realize that we talk shit because we don't have enough confidence to do that ourselves? I don't know if everybody else will admit that, but like I'm happy because and people will tell you about me, I love wearing a good suit. I for sure do. And dressing up, but Man, you're on, and I feel like I'm a pretty confident guy fashion wise, but you're on another level, bro.
Listen, I just have fun.
You do, and I love that about you. Like you're literally the only reason that any guy will ever say anything to you about anything like that is because they don't have the fucking confidence to do it themselves. I mean, be real. Do you
know what I realized? See. Love is one of the highest levels of consciousness you can get, and that's where you really see truth. And so when I'm going out at this point, someone's always had some shit to say to me, right? And I viewed them as, if I was in a good mood, I'd make friends with them and kind of flip the script on them. If I was in a bad mood, I'd make them feel bad. I'd make them feel stupid because I got pretty good at having these little witty comebacks, you know, because right. I always heard them. I had to. But do you know how many guys want to fight a sexy beast? Almost none. They want to find out what's going on. And do you know the guys that had something ugly to say to me, what I realized? And this is true of everyone. They just want to connect. They just want to connect. And even they don't know it.
Yeah.
But I realized it in this moment because I could see truth. And I flipped the script.
Isn't that the crazy thing about drugs?
Like drugs, that's what I think drugs are really for.
Sometimes drugs, yeah.
They're supposed to poke holes in our reality that we can see. They were never meant to. Most people take drugs to escape suffering. And that's what I started out doing when I was going out that night. I wanted to have a great time and escape suffering. But see, what really happened was with the combination of that love that I had for all these guys, it had this spiritual awakening effect on me.
Man, sometimes drugs just take away the blockers in your mind.
Yeah.
For some people, drugs are a Band-Aid, and I get that, and it's, you know, addiction is a terrible disease, and I don't, you know, that's another issue that we're not talking about here, but sometimes drugs...
Addiction.
They take away the blockers in your mind, and they...
Everyone has a drug of choice to escape suffering. Mine was women. Alcohol wasn't that hard for me to give up. I just had to become comfortable without it socially. But before, it gave me access to being out, to being around women. Women made me feel better about myself because I felt like I wasn't really worth very much. And if they loved me, then I mattered, right? And so everybody has this kind of drug of choice that they use to escape suffering because everybody is being this thing that they're not really. And it's causing them to suffer. It shapes their reality. It brings in events that cause more negative emotions that cause its existence.
Dude, mine was my social worth when I was in DC.
Mm-hmm.
Because I never like worried. I've always been fairly private with my relationship and my private life, and racing to me has always been a separate thing, but I never came from this high-strung lifestyle.
Right.
And so for the time that I lived and worked in D.C., to become a part of that, like, power elite,
yeah,
that was, like, I always, the entire time, I felt like I was faking it till I make it.
Yeah.
Because I didn't belong here. Like, all these people, they came for money, they had money. But I'm here. I'm like a chameleon, you know? I'm doing this thing. And that, for me, that was my, like, cover-up drug of choice. To be in this scene, to, like, win awards and do things to be seen. Right. And I had never before, and even after, since I moved here, like, I don't care about being seen. But when I was there, I was like, wow.
Yeah.
When I am seen, when I'm up on stage, when I'm getting an award,
right.
I was like, look at me.
You're worth more.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Dude, I was dicking around in L.A. for years. I mean, I said I was trying to be an actor, but really I was just trying to, I don't know, figure out who the hell I was or what's going on, or, you know. But that was another thing on my list was, like, you know, be an actor or something like that because I thought that's what I got to do. But yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And L.A. is a really great example of people pretending to be things that they're not.
Right.
I mean, what a crazy town. But to sort of wrap this up, right, you know, no guy wants to fight a sexy beast. Do you know how many girls also want to get into it with this? They don't want to cut it. They want to find out what's going on. And when I was being just in sexy beast mode, instead of, you know, I'm this don't fuck with me bad. Yeah. I mean, my whole reality changed.
Sexy beast mode. I love that.
My whole reality changed, Scott.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like I was just being cool to people and they were being cool back. It was like everything was different. I was resonating with them at a completely different level.
Right.
A completely different level than I was before. I wasn't trying to impress. I was just expressing who I really am. You know, I wasn't trying to worry about, like, what did they think of me? Didn't care. Didn't care because I was having a great time in the present moment. Wasn't worried about some future destination, about when I made this little agreement with my little fake image, about when I can be happy, about what kind of pants I got to buy or sunglasses I have to wear, car I need to drive, whatever that bullshit is. I was just being who I was. And my whole reality changed, man. And it wasn't like, okay, you know, the drugs wore off and that ended. The next night I went out and I wore a white linen suit. And it was the same damn thing. And I wasn't on anything that night. And then what really, really solidified the whole deal for me was I was driving up to Las Vegas to see my daughters. Like, you know, 2 days, 3 days after my little spiritual thing, my awakening, whatever. And I'm still coasting on this wonderful time we had with all my friends. I mean, they're still on the chat that they didn't want to be a part of. They're on the chat still messaging each other, you know. And I'm driving up there and I'm thinking, what kind of people are there going to be? You know, they're twin girls. I'm not there. I'm not physically there. You know, they're with their mother in Las Vegas. Like, what's going to happen? And I'm sitting there thinking about all this, and I realize, like, see, that image we project, we don't have to have this thing that we've built on, you know, a reactionary level, or we built it on, like, trying to avoid being hurt. We can put anything in there. And when you hold that image of yourself, that new reform within your mind's eye, you become it. You become it. Your thoughts and actions start to conform to it. And you become the person that you're projecting. That's how it works.
Right.
It's powerful. And I realize they're going to be okay. And so I get there, and I've got a hotel room at the Westin, right? And we had this wonderful time because I'm relaxed. I'm being who I really am. I'm not trying to, you know, like the vibe changed. They're having a great time. And anyways, we always have a wonderful time, but this time we're on the top floor. We're walking to the elevators, right? And one of them usually holds my hand. The other one kind of runs around. I don't know. For whatever reason, we don't hold hands at the same time, and I wouldn't worry about it. So we get up there, and we're standing there, and I'm waiting for the elevator to open, and one opens behind me, and Sherilyn walks into it, and I don't even really notice. And she says, "Daddy, look at me." And I turn around, and the elevator doors start to close. And I realize, oh, my God, that thing's going to close. And I reach out, and I'm trying to hit the button, trying to stick my hand in between the elevator doors, and it closes. And the thing goes, starts going. And I can hear her screaming. And they've never been really separated
right
before. Where's this thing going to go, Scott? Like, that's what's happening. Like, you start to realize, wait a minute, this thing could open up on any floor, and who knows who's going to fucking be there. I mean, there's guys with carts that they could just throw it right in there. There could be anything there right in Las Vegas. And I'm like, I'm hitting the button. And finally, the elevator comes back up, and I get in the thing, and she's not there. And I'm set. You know, I get down to the bottom floor. Where is she? Where is she? And I run up to the front desk girl, who I actually connected with, because I wasn't being the normal guy that I am. I was being the open, loving, joyful person I am.
Yeah.
And I explained the situation. I said, look, we got to get on the radio with somebody, because I used to be in the military, and I know how radios work, right? Anyways, long story short, I'm running up flights of stairs. I'm, baby, Sherilyn, nothing. And the longer this takes place, you know what happens, the worse it is.
Right.
She's not around anyone. And the little one, the other one, Virginia's just like, daddy, daddy, fun. So I left her at the front desk. Anyways, I come back down again. Mr. Hall, come with us. Not, we found your daughter. Mr. Hall, come with us. I'm like, ugh. Okay. We go to the basement. And it's not like a cute hotel. It's a basement. It's scary.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, why the hell did you bring my daughter if you have her to the basement? But I'm not saying anything because, you know, normally, Scott, if it had been the old me, I'd have been belting out orders, telling people what to do. But see, they'd have been like, screw you. Who the hell are you talking
right.
to? You're a shitty father here.
Right.
But I was working with these people. They wanted to help me. They wanted me to find my girl. And so I go down there, and there she is. Sherilyn is with the assistant, like, manager, general manager of the whole hotel and the human resources lady. And she's got Voss water and a rubber
just
ducky.
Chilling.
And just
she's
having a
life.
Great time. And she's actually
she's
worried that she's going to be in trouble. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, man, it was the sweetest damn thing when, you know, like, Virginia ran up and they hugged
each
other.
Dude, what a turn of a story.
Yeah. Yeah. But see, here's the thing. If it had been the old me,
yeah,
I'd have been yelling, angry,
yeah,
upset. And that would have traumatized
like, where's my fucking
both
kid?
Of them.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have known that I was just concerned. They had just seen my body language, the anger, right, the whatever. But what would have turned into some of this catastrophic like thing for them and scarred them became this cool little adventure. And that's what we have the power to do all the time, is to make everything joyful and experience in a way that's not so scary or fearful inducing and all this other stuff. But that's what really dialed it all in for me.
Yeah.
You know, because I wasn't the old me anymore. I was the guy who I really am when that happened. And
yeah,
ever since then, that's what I've been traveling down that road. And that's been, I mean, almost 2 years now.
Well, man, I think that your life has been, I love your life story. I love all the things that you do and I love talking about it.
This is what I want for everybody, Scott. I want them to be free, man. And that's the other thing I realized too. See, when I realized what was really going on with everybody, because everybody's got this thing to some degree. Mine was an extreme case, but everyone has this thing that's not really them, that represents them, and it causes them to suffer, and it manifests events on a loop because it has to support its existence. That thing, your comfort zone. Your comfort zone only goes so far as that image of yourself will allow it, because
right,
it doesn't know how to show up outside of it. You know, think about how much life you could live when you didn't have some entity that's based on negativity telling you how far you can go.
Oh yeah, no, I totally agree, because I think in the last several months of my life, due to things that have happened, I feel the same way. I think that we iterate it a little different, but that's what I love about talking to you is we have these like crazy conversations about vision and life.
Let me tell you about you, man. So, for the listeners, right at the beginning of the summer, we all went out to Lake Pleasant, and they've got these enormous cliffs that you can jump off of if you have the balls. And the only person that would do it first was me and Scott. And afterwards, we jumped off. How many cliffs did we jump off that day?
We jumped off a lot of cliffs.
We jumped off a lot of damn cliffs, and it was scary every single fucking time.
They kept getting higher and higher.
But, you know, you said something to me, man, afterwards. We were having something to eat, and you said, hey, man, you know, if we lived right around the corner from this place and went for a jog every morning and jumped off the cliffs as a way of sort of just kind of like capping off the jog, this wouldn't even be any big deal to us, would it?
No, it wouldn't.
And I remember thinking, damn, that's 100% right. We could totally dial that perspective in now and just not feel that fear. And that's how it all is, man.
Yeah.
It's all.
It's not about doing something
crazy. Your perception of things.
Yeah, it's just about doing something new. Because if we did that every single day, it wouldn't be shit.
Well, that's where all the miracles lie, man. It's into doing something new.
Yeah.
And do you know, I've been struggling, man, for the last like 6 months because I've been in this rut where I'm doing the same things every day on a loop and nothing's changing. And I know what's going on, and I still am succumbing to this pattern of behavior. And I know I've got to break it out, but I've learned so much during this time, too, so I can't complain a whole lot. But I'm telling you, it's that image. It's that crazy.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
Well, man, I'm stoked that you came and spent some time with me tonight. I legitimately, you are, I don't say this about a lot of people, but you are one of the most interesting people I've ever met. And I'm legitimately thankful for you in my life. I can't wait to have you back because I think that even just now sitting here thinking about the stuff you've done in the last year or two, that's a whole other podcast, I feel like. So, dude, I'm so thankful that you came and you agreed to come up here and chat with me tonight. I think everyone's going to love it. I'm stoked that you're here. I'm stoked that you're in my life. I can't wait to have you back. And, man, fucking just thanks for being a dude.
Scott.
Like, you're just a quality fucking dude. And I love that about you. I mean, I bromance out about a lot of people. The listeners right by now are not, you know, they know that I have people here to talk to me that I genuinely enjoy and are interested in. And you are like one of the lights of my life, man, for sure. And I mean that.
I appreciate it, man. And honestly, I feel blessed that I've met you, Travis, these other guys, Matt, you know, all the Matts, Sotch. I mean, gosh, I'm going to feel like an asshole if I forget somebody. But the thing is that what I really believe is that if you embrace these things and embrace the present moment, you start to see the joy, the wonderful things, and guys like you are in my life, and I've been blessed for it, man. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. All right, brother. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks to everybody listening.
Thank
fuck,
you,
dude.
It's been fun.
It's Christmas time, man.
I know.
Everybody fucking fuck.
I'm taking my daughters to Georgia to see my mother and stepfather. It's a dream for her and really me, but especially for her. And, you know, I hope everyone has a wonderful Christmas because this really is a time of healing and love is healing. And
for sure.
People can just love each other.
Absolutely.
And forgive. And forgive.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. Have a happy holidays, whatever you choose to do. I hope that you're with people that love you and that are around you. And damn, Merry Christmas, brother.
Merry Christmas.
Love you, man.